Would you rather?
We're going to do this one now? I thought...
Oh, you want to do this in the post-show?
I think post-show would be better because we're both going to be pretty lubed up by the end.
Okay, fine.
So, yeah.
We'll save the would you rather for the post-show.
It's a good one.
I needed help with an equation. An equation.
Okay.
Because I can't figure it out.
Okay.
It's probably nonsensical.
Okay.
So here's a shirt that Max was wearing. Uh-huh. And I saw the bottom part first. I'm like, oh, that's cute.
Uh-huh.
Q, T, and then the pi symbol.
Right.
But the top part. Genius plus dog wearing glasses equals cutie pie.
Genius puppy. Okay, so the shirt says genius. It's the font is sort of like a crayon
chalkboard.
Type thing. And it says the word genius plus. And then there's like a puppy with...
Just go to my Twitter and look at the picture.
With horn-rimmed glasses on. So, obviously a smart puppy. Or a puppy with very bad eyes that they decide to put some fashionable horn-rimmed glasses on.
With very annoying owners.
Equals Q, which, boy, I don't even... Q, what would Q stand for? T is time, and pi is, of course, pi. So...
Q times T times pi equals a smart dog.
Let me see what Wikipedia says for constants or other things that have Q. I'm curious.
I'm just tweeting this before I forget.
Hmm.
Did I ever show you this picture? This was when I was watching the movie Ted.
Okay.
And I noticed something on screen that looked very familiar, and you can probably see it from this picture I took of my television.
It's your television.
My television on my television.
Jeff has a pretty old television, too.
Yep. The weird guy
it's a backlit,
in...
It's a backlit projection.
Analog rear projection.
Yeah.
Yeah, the guy in Ted, when he's dancing to the Belinda Carlisle video, that's my TV. That's the 47-inch version. I got the 53-inch version. But it's still my TV. So I got a picture of it, like, framed inside my TV. It, I don't know. Claim to fame. I have a famous TV.
Okay, so Q... That's right. Q could be momentum transfer. Q could be heat. Or even electric charge. So... Q can be used in a lot of things. So genius plus nearsighted puppy equals...
Heat times time times...
Heat times time times pi. There's the answer to your question.
All right.
There's something to it.
I mean, even nonsense, even cutesy, wootsy, kid shirt thing, I can't figure out...
Yeah.
Other than the cutie pie is the only part that makes sense.
Right. But yeah, I guess it's because kids love puppies and kids are like little puppies...
And I can kind of see my kid's smart, and he uses the pi symbol, but the dog doesn't make any sense.
The dog doesn't really make any sense, and the glasses on the dog. I mean, come on, what is this, 1990? You can be smart without glasses now. We're past that point. Okay. We just went to a Chili Fest.
Yes, we did.
We were at the Mount Lebanon... Chili, I don't know, what was it called? Winterfest.
It was Mount Lebanon Winterfest. It benefited Relay for Life or something like that. And it was a competition all around. The chili vendors were all competing for votes, and the homebrewers were competing for votes.
And we have some interviews of the brewers that if we manage to get that out, we'll try to.
It's going to be roughly edited and probably only put in the post show. But it'll be there.
It'll be there. And, yeah, it was fun. We had a good time. There were some good chilies. There were some not so good chilies. There were some good beers. There were some not so good beers.
Mm-hmm.
And...
Now talk about the chili that you liked the best.
Oh, it was from the Walnut Creek?
Walnut Grove.
They used a green tomato chili, and they had pulled pork, and they just... Really, you know what was the kicker for me? They were all the other ones had, like, you know, they were just your standard tomato-based chili. And this was the one that was the real standout from the crowd. And I could taste the real effort that was put into the chili versus the other chilies, which were better. Some were better than others, but were, you know, mostly just kind of thrown together.
Yeah, I like the green tomato one. You know, and that was me tweeting the picture. I forget when if you use the send, you know, if you go to the photo album and you say share in Twitter, it goes tweet, tweet. Anyway, for non-traditional chilies, I liked the walnut, and that was really the only non-traditional one, was the Walnut Grove one.
Yeah.
This is, Heather picked this up at the Church Brewworks. It's her coffee stout.
Oh. Well, okay.
Today. Let's not drink too much so she doesn't get mad at me for drinking her coffee stout. That's the thing when you got a wife that drinks beer. She gets mad when you drink her beer.
You created this monster.
There's many more plus sides than negatives to this problem, but it is a concern now and again. The other chili that I really liked was, forget the name of the place, some small place in Mount Lebanon, but the guy had two chilies. He had a meat one, and he, same kind of thing. He used, you know, smoked pulled pork, and he had some brisket, and he kind of really blended together. He also made a vegetarian version, and they were slightly different. The vegetarian one, he added some cocoa and some something else to it. It had a neat, I liked both of those ones. And who did I end up voting for? I voted for the meated one. Well, actually, he didn't have two different. He just had one bucket, so I voted for him. I figured I'd just share the wealth because I agreed with Greg, and then I also like this other one as well.
We actually had one comment. I'm sorry, are we done with the...
Yeah, I'm done with chili.
Yeah. We actually had one comment on our new audio setup. Somebody said they liked.
Lefty-righty.
Lefty-righty. I'm trying to look up who that was. Give me a minute here. Do you want to... It was Padraic O'Broivy.
Patrick. Yeah. He's a local guy. He said he's listening to it at work in Upper St. Clair, and it sounds like we're sitting in, like, off to each side of him drinking beer.
It's going to take me some getting used to. It's just weird hearing myself in, like, just more in one half of my head than the other. But the only comment we had was that it was good, so I'll take that as okay.
Yeah, I mean, there's other podcasts I listen to where, especially if, you know, you don't intimately know the voices, it helps you assign a different attribute to who's who, right? And, you know, that's helpful. So I think I'm going to stick with it. I was hoping I could get away with less than double the file size, but because I thought MP3s did stereo kind of smartly, but apparently no, it's almost absolutely double the file size.
Because MP3s do their compression by psychoacoustics, and therefore you're just doubling it. Because all you're doing with it with MP3 compression is you're taking away the parts that the brain can't hear.
Right.
So
I remember with an old encoder that I was using, there was some settings about how to do stereo. And that's why I just presumed. Mm. This one doesn't give me options on how to do stereo, so I figured it was just doing stereo smartly. I can't remember the details on what those were, those how to do stereo things. But yeah, basically the bit rate of the file is double. So instead of doing the 48 kilobit version, we have to do a 96 kilobit version, so each channel gets its own 48 kilobits. And that's that. So double the file size.
But in today's world, you know, it was a different world in 2005 when we started this.
Yeah.
In today's world, I think the file size is okay. As long as you don't get over 50, and even then it's okay. But I mean, that's the point where, like, iPhones can only download it on Wi-Fi. So you like to have it available, but you can't always.
The podcast app will still play them, right? It'll still, like, play them, I think.
I'm not sure. I honestly don't know.
I think it does, but I'm not sure. I've never really paid attention to the sizes, but, you know, like, when I'm not on Wi-Fi, download buttons do go away, but if you tap on it, they'll start playing, like, a stream-type play. So,
job hunt update.
Okay.
I actually had my contract extended by 2 weeks, so it's not the end of this week that my contract's ending, but the end of 2 weeks from now. I got a interesting, you know, I got through a phone interview with one company, but they have a whole process where I have to take a couple online exams, and then, like, they explain the process to me, and it's like four different interviews, and I'm just kind of curious to see what that's like, you know?
Going through a crazy
interview. The last time that happened to me was, like, Free Markets, but I had already been a consultant there for 9 months, so...
You knew the people that were interviewing you.
So you know, I'm not enthused about this a ridiculous interview process like that. But on the other hand, like, I have another phone interview on Monday. I have some things in the fire. I think things are looking good. It might be just fun to do it.
Right.
Just for the hell of it.
Yeah, the... I always...
I figure if I go in not expecting anything and just do it, then, you know, maybe it's a surprise.
Is it 4 full days, or is it just a short bit each day, or...
It sounded like each interview was a couple hours. It was at least an hour, mm-hmm. but it could be on 1 day or 2 days.
I mean, because typically our interviews are, you know, 6-hour ordeals where you're basically meeting two people, then someone takes you to lunch, and you talk over lunch, and then you meet with, like, two more people, you know, so it's a full-day thing. For our interview process, but we don't generally have them do four, you know, very seldom do I see people coming back for a second look, or, you know, the interview is so in depth that it's 2 days. You know, I'd love to talk to some of these people that, you know, like Google, like how they do their interview process, because right. generally you can sum up a person pretty quickly and you're just spending the rest of the time, you know, vetting that initial opinion and making, because it doesn't usually it doesn't change.
Well, man, I think what they're looking for is they're looking not necessarily for a skills match, but for a chemistry mm-hmm. and sort of outlook match. And I'm not excited about that process in general, because it just seems like, you know, we'll figure each other out. That's what always happens. But whatever, you know, like I said, I'm not stressed about it, because I'm willing, you know, willing to go through the process. I am kind of stressed about the online tests, though, because I always feel that those don't really, they test book knowledge, but they don't test actual, like, programming. Like they focus on things that you know, you remember from your second year of programming class.
Yeah. I could see it going both ways, though, because some people put crap they don't know on their resume, too.
Yes.
You know? So, you know, they're trying to figure out where the steep drop-off is in that skill set, right? Like, does he know the first 8 things, or does he only know the first 2 things?
Right, right.
You know, so I could see where it could be useful for that, for kind of, you know, filtering out some
Well, I told him, you know, I haven't done Java in a while. My .NET's good, my Java mm-hmm. isn't, but... You know, then that's why they said, okay, you know, we don't expect you to do well on this one, but here's a Java one, here's a .NET one. So I plan to do those, I think, either Monday or Tuesday. I think I'll get those in.
Oh, so it's like a programming thing? Like, they give you a problem and you gotta...
It's an online exam thing. I think it's multiple choice. And
I see.
And they probably give you, like, code examples. Say, what will this output? That sort of thing.
Gotcha. Yeah, I see, like... interviews for engineers, and they're writing code on the whiteboard. I'm like, oh, that just doesn't sound like fun.
Well, you know, it's actually fun as long as people don't expect you to write correct code, as long as you can write mm-hmm. pseudocode. Because right. the point is not what is the absolute syntax here, because syntax is just something, you know, well, what was that command again? I'll look mm-hmm. it up, you know, or what is that? Oh, yeah, I missed the semicolon here, whatever it is. But the important thing is to know that you can figure out a logical way to do something, and or you figure out, you know, because there's easy ways and there's hard ways of doing things, and you're
right.
you're doing it in a good way.
Yeah, I mean, some people, they do write compilation quality code on the whiteboard,
yeah.
you know, just the way they are, and it's like, oh my goodness, that just seems so rough, writing like this whole function out on a on a whiteboard.
If I was interviewing somebody, I wouldn't be concerned with that as mm-hmm. much as I would be concerned with, you know, can they figure out just, you know, the basic logical progression of the problem.
Sure.
Yeah. But, you know, to each their own, I guess.
Yeah, I'm not saying that we expect compilation-ready code, but some people write it. And mm-hmm. I walk past because the conference room right by where I sit has a window on the door, and when you're going out the suite, you look in, you see some guy writing code on the whiteboard almost every day, so...
I mean, you don't think about it often, but coding really is a very creative position. I mean, it's a lot like engineering in that sense, mm-hmm. in that it's figuring out how to do a problem, and you have many ways to do it, and it's just what is the way that you do it, and so it's really an artful position,
mm-hmm.
even though it seems like
there are proven concepts that work, though.
Yes, absolutely.
sorting through data, things like that. Right. And, you know, I'm sure the interviewers are looking for some of that learned skill of, you know, generally accepted way of, you know, sorting this list is doing it, you know, so and so.
I don't want you to say, okay, I'm going to do a bubble sort, you know. But yeah, well, I don't know. We'll see what happens. I got like really anxious about Tuesday of last week because I hadn't heard from one of my contacts. And I was like, oh God, what's going on? And then I heard from her, and everything was cool, and there was more stuff coming along. And just I had to get over that sort of anxious hump, and then I got the extension. And it's like, you know, I think that things are going to work out fine.
Mm-hmm. Two more weeks to find the right job.
Yeah.
As long as you keep, you know, as long as all these resumes are turning into interviews and things like that, hopefully interviews turn into multiple offers and you can pick the one that's the best.
That's what I want. I want to be, I want to be a tug of war. I want there to be a bidding war. That'd be cool. Nice. What happened to the Alley Show?
The Alley Show. I was just thinking about today. I'm like, oh, I haven't uploaded that. I'll get that up.
All right.
What should we call it? Do you remember what we talked about?
Well, we talked about her going to the gym, and we talked about some jokes. We did some jokes on the show, but it's the Alley Podcast.
Okay,
it's her podcast.
Well, sure,
I was just there to to ask the question.
Yeah, I have it there. I just got to put a title tag on it, and then I'll upload it to the page, and then Alley will be a 2-time podcaster, and we'll do a third one probably this week if she's into it.
Okay, all right, let's get into it.
Get into it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I've been
your theory of the universe.
Sort of. It's so hard for me to put it down because there's I've, you know, talked all about how, you know, looking at science, and I'm trying to understand it all, and of course I can't. But I'm also starting to look at how it all kind of fits together. And I want to also put a whole bunch of qualifiers around this. I'm not saying this is actually how things work. I'm not saying that this is something that I can't be convinced is wrong. So I don't want to, you know, put out that, oh, this is my theory of everything. This is just an idea. Okay?
Okay. Greg is not a particle physicist.
I would have loved to have been. Okay, where do I start? What is everything?
What is everything?
Yeah.
You want me to try to answer that, or are you just setting me up?
No, well, I'm going to try to make you follow along.
Okay. But I mean, you know, it's some of these are going to sound very ignorant, right? Because I haven't thought about it on the same level as you have. So, like, you know, my first question is, what does Greg mean by everything? You know, like, matter. Well, he means more than matter. He means space-time, you know, and all that stuff, right? So now I'm thinking, like, what is everything, and how can I concisely say this? Like, you know, my first head is something like, you know, I want to say something like manifestation of energy or something like that.
Yes. So. Right. That's right. It's energy. I mean, even space-time itself, without energy, there's no difference between one space-time or another space-time. There's nothing. So energy is a stress. Space-time is a stress-energy tensor. Without energy, there's nothing there. Everything is a manifestation of energy in one way or another. What does that mean? What happened 13.7 billion years ago? We don't know, but something went. Some calamitous event occurred. Everything after that is an echo. Everything.
Right. I get what you're saying. Where, what do you mean everything's an echo? Well, he doesn't mean literally sound waves. You know, and because like when you first hear that, someone might think, I'm going to play the other side, right? Or someone thinks, oh, we're saying we're all an illusion, we're all ghosts or something. And I don't think that's what you mean. I think what you're saying is energy is reverberating and losing energy and turning into matter and turning into light and turning into, and it's all.
It's slowly reverberating and slowly dying. It's slowly going away. There was this burst, And we are living in the aftershocks of that burst.
And we are just...
Bits of that burst.
That's the crazy part of the idea, I think, right? Mm-hmm. You know, we just... This shockwave of stuff actually evolved complex organisms.
Yeah.
You know, where it's... Like, because if you... A lot of ways, you like when we're talking about space-time or 4D, we distill it down to 3D or 2D, you know, to get our heads around ways to describe those extra dimensions that we can't see. And you're kind of doing something similar where you're distilling down
this poetry.
Theory yeah. to something like a shockwave, a sound wave. And when you think about it that way, it's like so weird. Like, how could that possibly arise to give you know... How can intelligence and complex organisms arise out of that? You know, that's the thing that's like counterintuitive when you think, when you do this kind of distillation.
It's counterintuitive, but if you look at the rest of the universe and the rest of what's going around, it actually makes sense. If you take the idea that everything is just an echo of that original burst, some of it has turned into these luminous stars, gigantic fusions, and it's taking, you know, it's combining the energy and then bursting it out again. Some of it has just condensed into dust. Some of it has turned into planets where there are these things on it, like us. And what do we seek out as life forms? We seek out energy. We actually outshine the sun. If you take how much energy you and I are putting out, and you take the same volume of the sun and how much energy is that's putting out, it's less. So,
okay,
it really is. You put out more energy per capita than the sun. If you were the size of the sun, you'd be putting out more energy.
I guess that's because not all of the sun is going through fusion.
Exactly. It's because you're taking energy from around you. The sun has all of its energy inside of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's not taking any more energy. I mean, it can, but almost our sun isn't. But life is about taking energy, about taking the bits of this echo that are out there and integrating it into ourselves and propagating it further down the line.
Mm-hmm.
So everything's about sort of propagating this echo of creation of energy, whatever it was, when it really was a tap on a cymbal.
Right. At a certain point, though, it's hard to keep calling it an echo, right?
I'm using the word echo as poetry.
Right.
But it definitely set everything vibrating.
Oh, sure. Okay. Yeah, I mean, actually, like when you start thinking about echo, I mean, I'm trying to like, maybe I shouldn't. Maybe I'm getting hung up too much on the word, but I'm thinking about like, you know, energy not being created is not, or I guess condensed and like amplified at certain points. But I guess, you know, sound waves could do that too. You know, mm-hmm. they could get into a pattern and,
you know,
and amplify.
That's why
other.
I say, you know, a symbol is an idea that mm-hmm. I had in my head when I'm thinking of this. You know, if nothing hits it, it's nothing. Nothing happens. But once something hits it, it reverberates. The pattern just keeps reverberating through. And if it were if it were in space, it would continue to reverberate. Now, that's applying a three-dimensional object into 4D space. The math doesn't all work, but the symbols just represent. It's just like when you see people representing space-time as a 2D sheet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's not how it actually works, but it's good enough for representation.
Right.
So, okay, so everything out there, everything in the universe, in one way or another, is either an echo or a reverberation of this bits of energy. We have adapted ourselves into a particular niche. Here's where it gets into some weird bits of psychology. Okay. We are... it's hard to explain. So, forgive me. we're social apes. We talked about this before. We are built upon billions of years of evolution and lots of structures that existed in the past, particularly in our brains. We have a common ancestors with reptiles. We have common ancestors with all the mammals. We have common ancestors with fish. Those structures are still visible in our brains. We've built up. We've talked about how evolution is sort of a. It's lousy at what it does in some ways because it takes the easiest way, and so in order to help us adapt to the situation that we were in, intelligence was what it came up with, and it came up with this long gestation period and wrinkling the brain over and over and over again until you have all this stuff on top of all this stuff on top of all this stuff. And then we develop this thing called consciousness, and what really is it? I think it's a bunch of different processes running around in your brain. And we can see that by fMRIs, we can see that by how we examine stuff. Now, you and I, all humans, see the world in fundamentally the same way. We experience the world mostly through our eyes. We also experience the world through our ears. A little bit of touch. Our ears and touch are really the same forces, right? I mean, it's all electromagnetic forces when it all comes down to it. But we see a small portion of the electromagnetic spectrum. We feel and we hear. And that's generally how we interpret the world. A pit viper can see heat. We can't. There are types of fish. A shark can sense electricity in the water. We don't have that sense. Catfish are basically huge tongues. They can sense the chemistry.
Right, they can taste on their skin. Yeah. There's bees. Bees can detect the electromagnetic signals of flowers. That's how they pollinate all one kind of flower. They use that as a big... It's more so than color, I guess. They can tell, like, this is the flower I'm pollinating because it has this... signal.
Well, some of these structures are still there in our brains. They've been adapted to other things. But what if, for whatever reason, in some circumstances, we know that we can remember things wrong. We know that we can have short circuits of the brain. What if we sense something, a part of the brain senses something in a way that's different from the way you normally sense it. The way that you've built a stochastic model of how the world works, and some part of your brain gets turned on for a slight moment, and you sense something, or you feel like you sense something that isn't like what you've experienced before. How would you interpret that? How would anybody?
Oh, I see where you're going. Talking about religion.
I think that...
deities.
Well, I think that... religion is... I think you'd interpret it as spiritual. I think unless you were very hardcore rational about everything, you would interpret that sensation as spiritual. And I think that when we're with other people, we get that a lot. Birds flock with each other, and the birds aren't necessarily conscious of what they're doing, but they move with the flock. When you're around other people, you can feel the energy of other people, and that can feel spiritual to you.
Mm-hmm.
It's all, though, goes back to that big burst in the beginning. It's all just that initial smack of energy.
Okay. Take a big leap from psychology way back to the Big Bang. Too big of a leap, probably.
Maybe too big of a leap. But my point is that the religious person looks at that energy and says, that's God. That's what gives life. That's what gives material reality to the universe. The politician, instead of looking to sees power as a way of manipulating people and things. But the scientist says, look at what we can do with this power. Look at the things that we can make it do. But it's all aspects of one general universal truth, which is that there was a burst of some sort. And everything that came after that is the dying echoes of that burst. It's fundamental that it's dying.
Okay.
It's dying. Entropy. It's going away. That's not very godlike if you ask me. It's dying.
Mm-hmm.
What does it all mean? I haven't put it all together yet. I have not tried to formalize this. These are all ideas that are just floating around in my head. But it matches everything in my mind so far. It okay. fits together. Some places somewhat oddly. But it kind of sort of explains it all. Which is probably a reason why it's wrong. But I can look at everything and see the aspect of this that guides it.
Sure. I mean, I understand what you're saying. I don't have too much to add. Maybe if I let it sink in for a while, I could come up with something. But got nothing to add right now.
I mean, I can define energy mathematically.
I mean, I think your takeaways, you know, your interesting takeaways. I mean, for me, the curious thing is thinking of everything as a shockwave, an afterglow, a reverberation,
right,
and watching complexity arise out of that. It sounds, you know, like I said, counterintuitive at first, but kind of fascinating to think about that, especially if you are drawing the parallels to a waveform.
Yeah.
You know, things like that. You actually did tie in the whole psychology, spirituality thing later on, where you talked about the reason, the essence of existence, right? Right. Mm-hmm. So you know, next time you tell the story, pull that in a little bit sooner,
because okay.
so, you seemed a little whack jobby when you were just like, why are you, how you like this psychology goes all the way back. Well, you went from physics, you jumped right into psychology. And you're like, it's the same thing, you know,
yeah.
And that there was definitely a huge gap that no one could bridge. So.
I didn't make the chain fold there. No, it's true. Like I said, I mean, I haven't written all this down yet. This is just floating around in my head. I'm just,
right.
This is an outline.
Right.
I can't help but feel there's something to it. I mean, we know from the quantum world, everything's shaking a little bit. The reason why we have what we call virtual particles, well, they're not actually particles. They can't actually be particles. What they are is the field is perturbating around the ground state. It's vibrating.
Mm-hmm.
There's excess energy. What is energy? The scalar quantity that's conserved in interactions, that doesn't tell you much. The time-like length of a space-time four-vector, that doesn't tell you much. But the essence of everything and a vibrating bit of something that happened long ago, that kind of tells you something.
Right. I was listening to, I don't think I talked about this, stop me if... Of course you will. Stop me if we have. I was listening to a radio lab, and I haven't gotten through the whole thing yet, but the beginning part, it was about speed. Slow, long time periods, and then super, 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 super fast. And, you know, they start off talking about the pitch drop. And you're familiar with this experiment that's been going on forever, and
sure.
They have webcams.
Yeah.
They had the sap type pitch.
Oh, right, okay. The black pitch, yeah, and they had webcams on this pitch, and occasionally... A drop. They actually never caught it.
No,
right?
They never caught it. So, like back in the 90s, early 90s or so, they had cameras on it, and the guy went away for a weekend, and the cameras malfunctioned, and it missed the drop. It's almost like, so they've, you know, because it's one of those, it, the reason they talked about the pitch in Radiolab was, it's this one thing where the period is so long, you know, decades.
Right.
And then, you know, the event is so rapid. It's like the two, it's so compelling because it's the two ends of our comprehension of speed, you know. Mm-hmm. It's like the slowest thing you can comprehend almost, and it's, you know, something falling in just less than a second or whatever is, you know, one of the fastest things. I'm not talking about like true comprehension, but yeah, you know, just in day-to-day casual comprehension. So I think that's why it's so fascinating. Everyone would love to see the pitch drop because it hasn't dropped in 30 years, you know, or something like that. It's been less than 30 years, but you know, it's in like 20 years. The couple of things that were, I found fascinating about the Radiolab, but they're talking about what, you know, you're living in the past, you know, light takes time to get to your eyes, but really that's the quick part, you know, getting the, seeing the pencil and me putting together the thought, hey, that's a nice pencil. I would like to grab the pencil, you know, and like all, like how it rattles around your brain and how long it takes, you know, it's kind of fascinating and like how everyone is like, how many, they said it was, it would take 20 milliseconds for you to like recognize, you know, comprehend the pen on the table type thing or something like that. I wish I could remember the numbers better. So the guy was, you know, Robert and Jad were trying to figure out, you know, what's the fastest thing you can experience? And it actually visual, you don't want to do visual, it's sound. You know, we've been wired to respond to jarring sudden sounds. Mm-hmm. It actually, there's a short circuit, literally like a bypass circuit where it doesn't go to the brain, it goes straight to your spinal cord. And so like within, I think it's like, I want to say 1/100th of a second, you know, you'll react, you'll jerk to a, you know, to a startle.
It's like the Joe Schmo deaf girl who couldn't stop herself from reacting to the champagne burst. Because it was wired into her.
Yeah.
You know, she can hear. So.
Yeah. Yeah. But that's the fastest thing you can experience is being startled by a loud sound.
Mm-hmm.
It's just the way your physiology is. That's the thing that your body will react to the fastest, even though it's all subconscious, you know, once it enters your brain.
Yeah. Once it's like, or when Allie came to the door in a couple episodes ago.
Yeah.
It would just boom. What? And you know, it was, we call that being afraid, but it's not being afraid, it's just being startled. But the natural reaction is, whoa.
Yeah.
Point to it, because it's something unexpected. And yeah, it's reptile like. It just boom. What the heck was that? You mentioned time, and you know, I told you the second definition I had for energy, and I think it all points back, because I said a space time four vector, the length of that in the time direction is how you could define energy. So energy and time are intricately linked, and so is space. So it's all together,
mm-hmm.
you know, one construct. So it's very interesting from a mathematical point of view.
You know, I was recently thinking about time in a different way, much different way, where how the accuracy, the precision of time, you know, in used to be within a day. You know, like there was no good way to specify a more accurate time than a day, and it really
sundial
didn't matter.
Sort of do it.
Yeah, but I mean,
it was sunny.
Yeah, but even you know then, or you know, the sun doesn't have been around for a long, long time. But you know, there's a, you know, like think agrarian. You know, there weren't very many meetings, and the meetings didn't have to start within. You know, the precision was hours. You know, it was afternoon. Me see you in the afternoon. You know, so, and like, it's almost crazy thinking that, you know, humans didn't have time precision or cognition of this, you know, any finer grained than, you know, what it was. And I wish I had more, you know, concrete examples of that. But if you go look into it, it's fascinating how.
And I think that applies to lots of things, not just time. For example, our concept of communication has changed so much in the past 20 years. We talked about how, you know, if you leave home without a cell phone, you feel a lot more naked than you would have 20 years ago. That would not have been an issue. There's something about just the relentless the relentless march of progress mm-hmm. causes changes in how we model everything, and yeah. and that just and that will keep going.
It'll be curious to see what my kids are like when they're teenagers.
Right.
You know, I mean, it would be, I can certainly see where they will have their most peer interaction, not face to face. You know, they'll be hanging out with their friends and having their, you know, it's sad. It sounds sad to hear it, but I think it's very likely their most meaningful interactions will be through a device of some sort, you know, online.
I think that's probably true. And, you know, it makes you kind of understand why there are people who just get overwhelmed with it all and just go back to nature, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not one of those people. I don't have that proclivity in me. I love the stuff, but I understand why some people can get overwhelmed with it. Some people's brains can't tune into that frequency. They can't adjust. So
I think it's going to be a big thing to make sure your kids get the socialization. I mean, because it's going to be so tempting to not have this go out and play. You know, the play on my computer is so much more engaging than playing out in the woods. But, you know, there is something about, you know, we've evolved and we get changed that fast. So we need some of that other stuff to be healthy, you know, just a feeling that I have. And I think it's going to be a challenge to get them to, hey, why don't you have, you know, two of your friends over? Why do I want two of my friends over when I can talk to 20 online?
Uh-huh.
You know? I mean, so I think that's going to be some of the arguments, you know?
Well, I mean, remember when there used to be the idea of a LAN party? Now mm-hmm. that's kind of silly. We can Skype with each other and do mm-hmm. internet stuff, so what's the point?
Right. But I mean, that thing there, like, why would I want to hang out with two friends when, you know, 50 of them are right there?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's going to be a big challenge for parents going forward.
We'll adapt. We always did, and we're never going to understand it. And our kids will, and they're going to bemoan us for the fact that we don't understand it. And then their kids are going to have the same problem, and it's just going to keep happening until all the energy goes away. But yeah, I mean, the thing that I would take from the philosophy that I'm describing is that don't worry about it. You're going to die. Everything is going away. It's just the way it is.
Mm-hmm.
Don't worry about it. The piece of you, one way or another, will continue on until it's gone.
Sounds good. I just hope it doesn't happen too soon.
I like experiencing this stuff, yeah. But don't, you know, try not to get too wrapped up in it.
You should definitely become a prepper.
I don't like guns.
You don't need guns. You just need to build a big fortification to keep out the people with guns at that point.
I want to become a physicist, not a prepper.
Oh, I was watching the Prepper show. Just caught it one night. I'm like, yeah, I'm going to see what this is about. And, oh my goodness, the money they spend. The money they spend. And I mean, everyone.
The money other people must make by supplying that.
Well, that's it. I'm like, how do these people have this income? And they're crazy preppers. Like, they spend. You know, guy spent $500,000 making this all-terrain car thing that will drive over Armageddon, you know, Escape from Thunderdome. How do you get $500,000 that you can, of disposable income, to feed your fanatical obsession?
I don't know, but
how do people that crazy get that rich? That's my question, I think.
Everyone's crazy. Everyone. No one's normal. Everyone is fucking nuts.
Okay. But how do they get, how do ones that are that crazy get that rich?
The internet.
Yes, must be.
They get on TV shows. You know, mm-hmm. It's a dying medium, but
maybe that's it.
Still has money in it. I don't know. Somebody boy, is that going to be laughing at Armageddon. Ha ha ha! I can drive around and you're stuck. But I'll be laughing at him because I'll be saying, it's okay, my energy is going to be dispersed anyway.
I mean, I get the hobby part of it. Like, you know, part of his hobby is taking this crazy truck out into the, you know, he lives in California, so the, you know, the desert, the mountains there, and, you know, burying caches of supplies. So he has caches of supplies, of weapons, food, and all kinds of stuff buried all over California.
Does this mean he's not a muggle?
Oh, geocaching. Well, he uses his GPS. I wonder what happens when the GPS network goes down, if he can find his caches.
Didn't think of that one, did you?
But, I mean, I can kind of say, okay, so that's his hobby. You know, he goes out and hides, not geocaches, for other people to find. He hides guns wrapped in, and he hides them. He puts them in PVC tubes and he buries them vertically so they're harder to find with metal detectors and whatnot. I mean, it's crazy shit. And he has, you know, I forget what he said, but, you know, dozens and dozens of caches hidden, like, in every direction, because he doesn't know which direction he'll be able to flee in, right? So he's planning for all these contingencies. He has caches to the north and to the south and to the east and...
Oh, more power to him.
Crazy ass preppers.
People were prepping for Armageddon long before the internet was around. So, I mean, It's something people naturally do.
And they, the show's great because they rate the people's preparedness. It's like, he only had a year's worth of food.
Oh, if only there was like a Simon Cowell and like a judging.
Well, they give him a score, a prepper score. And like, he only had a year's worth of food.
Uh-huh.
You know, so they knocked off some points because he like didn't have any kind of sustainable like garden or anything like that, right? And then he's like, but he had, you know, 800 gallons of gasoline on his truck, you know, so that'll last him far. So we give him some points for that. Insane how they score his preparedness.
800 gallons of gasoline.
Maybe it wasn't 800, but it was an obscene, it was at least 500 gallons of gasoline in
that
his truck.
That is just a ridiculous amount of gasoline. That is one car where you hit it, it will explode. It will go poof. May take a little bit of time to get this the stochastic energy right. But yeah, it's wow. Okay, I have more to talk about, but this has been a long enough show already. Pre-show.
Yeah, 47.
And we do have an interesting question for the post-show, which will take up a lot of time, I'm sure.
Would you rather?
Would you rather?